Hello, welcome to my presentation about ImmuDB. And in this talk, I'd like to show you how you can use mathematics and cryptography, and especially how ImmuDB is using mathematics and cryptography to secure your safety critical systems. My name is Bartłomiej Święcki, and I'm a programmer for more than 10 years. I also worked as a DevOps in various companies. And I really like open source Linux and cryptography in general, especially applied cryptography. And in the free time, I'm spending my time with family and run from time to time. And in June 2021, I joined Code Notary as a senior team member. And right now, I'm also a core ImmuDB developer. So a little bit about the company itself. So it's a startup which is focused on securing CI/CD pipeline, something that we refer to today as DevSecOps. So it's all about making sure that the dependencies that you're using in the software are trustworthy, that your software is marked itself as a trustworthy, and then about monitoring the production environment and making sure that everything that is running there is trusted. And if it is not, to quickly give you information what you should replace with a new version that doesn't contain some vulnerabilities, to fix your production environment, to make sure that everything there is running as it should. Code Notary also provides a public and free community attestation service, CAS, where everyone can register and notarize assets or like Docker images that they're built. And then someone else can very easily check if given asset was marked as trusted by a specific signer ID. And this community attestation service and other products at Code Notary are built on top of ImmuDB, which is currently used a solid technological foundation that ensures that everything inside is secured as much as possible. So what is ImmuDB? So it's a new database written in Go. It's an open source database in Apache 2 license. And it was built from ground up. And when designing the database, immutability and tamper resistance were first class citizens. So everything is built around those concepts. And it has some unique features, like it can give you proof of its state. It can prove that some values are part of the state, but also you can do a time travel, like see what the state of the database was in the history. We also have a few more features like data expiration and direct S3 storage support, and a few more. And all products currently running in Code Notary are based on ImmuDB. So let me right now have a deep dive into internals of ImmuDB, and I will try to show you how we can use mathematics to prove that some data was not tampered with. So in order to understand much higher concept, let's start with something simple. Let's imagine there is a system with just one value. Here we have an example of a hello world. So what we can do with this value is we can apply some kind of cryptographical hash function like SHA-256 here, and then we get this hash value somewhere. And let's say that this hash value is the state of the system, something that we can very easily watch, observe. And this whole system would have this property that if the value changes, we can very easily spot that the value was changed by just observing the state. And because this is hash function, cryptographical hash function, this state actually does not reveal anything about the value, so the value is safe, but also it cannot be faked. So the database cannot say that my state is some different value. Why? Because then we ask for the value itself and we see that the value does not match the hash. So the database cannot easily fool the user, claiming that it contains a value different than what the state exposes. And of course, this is a very, very simple, very, very simplified view. And in standard database systems, we don't work on one value only, because we have multiple values. So let's add some more to the picture. Like here, we have two strings, hello world and hello false them. For each of them, we calculate the state separately. So we have the hash of the hello world string and hash of the hello fosdem string. So right now we have two values that we should observe. So we can still observe two values, but if the database grows and has millions of values, observing millions of hashes will be, of course, impractical. It won't scale. So instead of watching separate hashes, what we can do is we can concatenate those hashes and hash them once again to have one cumulative hash. And we can add more values to the picture. Like right now it's February 2022. So let's also add those values into the system, hash them, concatenate those hashes, hash them again, and then we have those parent hashes of both, let's say, parts of the system, halves of the system. And we can apply this rehashing recursively. So we take left hash, right hash, concatenate them into one value, rehash them, and we come up with just a single value, which is a global state of the database. And you can already see that this looks similar, and this is a well-known structure called Merkle tree, known for many, many years already. Just one warning, you have to watch for something called second preimage attack if you work with Merkle trees, because that may reduce the security of the system. And what properties does this Merkle tree give us? So each value contributes to the hash in equal manner. So any change in any of the value would just completely change the hash, because it will start, if let's say change the hello world, it will change the intermediate hash, then the parent up to the root. So there's no way to change the value without changing the root hash. So if we observe the state, we can very easily say if something has changed inside the database. Also, it's important to note that the value order is important. If we, let's say, swap hello world with hello fosdem, many parts of the tree will be the same, but at some level, like this hash here, the hash will compute different value, and up to the root will also continue, will also have different value. The change will propagate it. So we cannot reorder even values without the state being changed. And also an important property about Merkle tree, and important if this is protected against this second preimage attack, you cannot come up with different set of values of those leaves and claim that the state is the same. So the state is only valid for that particular set of values. If you are able to find different set of values producing the same state, that means that you have basically broken the hash function. You found the collision. And we assume that finding collisions in very good cryptographical functions is not practically possible. There's one extra property, because if the database ever claims that the state is of given value, and if we know that some value like this February contributed to the state, it can never deny existence of this value. So the database cannot say that, no, this value was not here. So it's a proof that the value is here, and this proof can be done for each of the values. And let's take a look at an example of such proof. So how database can mathematically prove us that the value is inside its state. So database claim is year 2022, because that's the last value in its state. Yeah, but we say we don't trust you. Prove it to us. So the database gives us some kind of weird formula, some calculations, and calculates the root hash. And yeah, the question is, where are those different hashes from? So they are built based on the Merkle tree itself. So we want to prove that given value 2022 contributed to the root hash. So what we can do is we can start with the value and try to reach the root from that value. If by applying multiple hashes, multiple recursive hashes can get to the root, that's a proof. Database then cannot deny that this value was not inside the state. We then basically prove that the value is inside the state of the database. So let's try to do this. We start with 2022, we hash this value, we have the hash, and now we want to move one step upwards. So in order to calculate the hash, we also need to have the left sibling. So the database actually have to provide us explicit value for this left sibling hash. So we get this from database, we get the right one from the previous hash calculation, we concatenate those values, hash them again, and we come up with the next level. And we recursively repeat this process. So the database has to give us this left sibling hash. We concatenate those hashes, hash them again, and we come up with the root. So the proof, what actually is the proof? The proof is the set of these hashes, this green one and this red one, which let us come up from the value up to the root of the tree. Okay, so this proves that the value contributed to the root hash, and also this proves that the value was at a specific location in the Merkle tree, because if it was in different tree, you know, we would have to swap the calculation of the hashes so we can check if this formula is actually correct to also validate the position. So we trust the database and we know that the current state is 104 something. And we say, yeah, we trust it, but only this time. Why? Why is it important that only this time? Because of course our databases are changing, the values are changing, and the root hash will just change over time. It will not stay the same. Once we do even a smallest update to the database values, it will be just completely different. So let's try to think about how we can make this Merkle tree something that can be dynamic. And there is a very interesting structure called appendable hash tree, which is a specific subtree where there is only one operation available, which is appending new values at the end. So we come up with a first version of the tree. We have three values, A, B, and C. For simplicity, those will already be hashes of those values. And we know that when we calculate the root hash, we come up with value RH1. And we can do append operation and come up with a little bit different Merkle tree that is built on top of values A, B, C, and D. And this ends up with root hash 2. Right? Important thing to notice here is if you take a closer look, you can figure out that majority of the tree is shared between those two Merkle trees. So the H1 and everything below is exactly the same in both trees. And of course, if this tree will be huge, we will have very big part of the tree shared between those two states. Okay, so let's see how the database can prove that those two trees are consistent. So database claims that the current state is RH2 after the change. And let's say that, yeah, but we know that the state just before was RH1, this root hash 1. So database, please prove to me that RH2, that the Merkle tree, the newest one, is consistent with the old one. And what does it mean that it is consistent? It means that all the values I've seen before, I could see before in this root hash 1 Merkle tree, are still in root hash 2. Yeah, and database, yeah, just says to us, yeah, here's the proof. Okay, so this is not as simple as with the proof for the value. So let's get a little bit deeper dive into this. So this is what the database gave us. So let's think for a second, what's the most primitive way of proving that those three are consistent? So what we could do is we could ask the database, please give me all the values you had since the beginning up till the current state. And the database gave us A, B, C, and D. We know that the previous state was made when there were only three values. So we take the first three values and build those the root hash only from those three values. And it's exactly this first calculation. RH1 is, so we calculate left subtree, left subhash, concatenate it with C, and calculate the cumulative hash. And also we do the same for this root hash 2. So the new root hash that the database claims is the current state. We take those values, build the hashes recursively, and finally we get to the root hash 2, right? And what you can observe here is that there are certain parts of those calculations that are equal. And this is exactly what we've seen before, that the parts of the tree are equal in both states. So instead of asking the database to give us all the leaf values, we can say, yeah, database, give me only the C and only this H1, because this H1 proves me that A and B are inside the database. So we can just basically extract those common subtree hashes into a specific values. And when we do this replacement, we end up exactly with what the database gave us. So both for the root hash one and both and the root hash two. So what database gave us, it gave us formulas to calculate both hashes for the old and the new tree and prove to us that the old state is what we knew and the new state contains all we had before. So it's like basically just calculating the root hash from scratch but with some optimizations. Okay, so let's say that database has proven to us that the new state is consistent with the old one. So we remember the new state right now because we have proven the new state is valid and we store it and say that we trust this new state. But next time we do any operation with the database, we will check again. So the normal flow over time is like that. Each client must have some kind of, must remember the old state that it knew from the database. And when there's new operation, we say that we know that the state was valid on that transaction at that time. And the new state has to be proven that it is consistent with the old one. And each verified operation needs to then ask for the next proof. And on every such operation, we basically just prove that the new state is still consistent with the whole history. And there are many, maybe multiple clients which do this operation independently. And if there's any corruption in the database, then the database won't be able to prove that the state is consistent. Yeah. And this is exactly how ImmuDB looks like under the hood. Here I will show you a simplified view because this is only for a single database and ImmuDB can have multiple databases in one process. But it's more or less the same because databases are totally independent. So each database has its Merkle tree root to be able to prove to perform the proofs. And of course, things are not that simple as with just a simple Merkle tree because it's a transactional database. So each transaction may add multiple entities into the database. So here we have n entries. Each one is key, metadata, and value. Key, of course, and value, we know what it is. Metadata is some kind of extra information that we use to mark things like deletion of a record. And we want to add a set of values into the database, and so we could just add them one by one into the main Merkle tree. But this causes some issues when we talk about transactional databases, because it's very hard to implement something that will be ASIC compliant, that you either commit all or none. So what we do instead is for each transaction, we build a small static sub-Merkle tree, which has exactly the same properties. So it can prove existence of each entry inside the tree. And out of that tree, we have the root hash, and this root hash is only the input for the main Merkle tree. So now if we ask for the proof from ImmuDB, more or less what ImmuDB is doing is just takes the key, this low-level entry. For this low-level entry, builds a proof inside this subtree. From this proof, we know that it contributed to the subtree having given root hash. And for this root hash of the subtree, creates a second proof that it is consistent with the main Merkle tree. So we can, from the value, go through the subtree and up to the root of the main Merkle tree. This is all not everything inside the database, because if we have key value, we may want to have a quick lookup for keys. So give me value behind that key. And to do this efficiently, we also need some kind of index, and ImmuDB has built-in B tree for that. And also the B-tree is not only tell us what the current value is, but it also can give us a history of given entry, yeah, because we can easily add multiple entries with the same key as before. And this may be a little bit confusing for people, because we usually say that ImmuDB is an immutable database. And this immutability is applied onto the history. So once you add something into the history, it is always a part of the history of this database. You cannot wipe this history, you cannot erase it. And the MindMerkle tree proofs are actually built on top of the whole history of those entries. And this part that I've shown you so far, it's something that we called embedded ImmuDB. And this is a Golang module. You can easily just take it, embed it into your own application, and have ImmuDB built into your own process. It's very simple. But also you can run ImmuDB as a standalone server. And this server provides two APIs. Like, there's a key value API, and there's also an SQL API. And let's take a look at those APIs quickly. Okay, so first is the key value API. And this is pretty low level API and has very low overhead. And so because of that, it's very fast. It's very close to the low level disk operations, and it's very stable and battle tested. It's because we used it at Cognitive projects, but also there are fintech and government and community projects that are currently using ImmuDB key value interface. It may be a little bit hard to work with, because key value interfaces, basically, they don't have many robust functionalities. Like, it's very hard to index data using multiple properties. Or if you want to ensure that there's data, the data is consistent, you have to do this validation by yourself. There's no foreign keys, and there's no schema. It's just bytes. Key and value are just raw bytes. We have simple functionalities like get and set value. We have a scan operation that can scan over a range of values with given prefix, for example. We have also something called references to other keys, where you set a value that is referenced to something else. Could be also referenced to something else in given point in time in the history. That's a very interesting property. And then when you try to read it, you will get the referenced value instead of the value directly written. We also have sorted sets, which help creating indexes. Also, for each key, you can create the history of a key. And also, we have verified operations like verified get and verified set. And you can easily use this key value API by just using our dedicated SDKs for a few languages. We have them. Contrary to a key value API, we also have SQL API, which is pretty robust as an SQL standard. It has tables, it has indexes, typed columns, null values, so everything that you expect from SQL. Also supports standard operations like insert, update, delete, select. We also have one weird operation, which is called upsert, which is a mix of insert and update. And it was initially done for performance purposes, so you could either insert new record or update existing record, but all columns at once. And this SQL API is something that we still actively work on. So from time to time, it may become unstable. And some features are still missing, like altering table foreign keys or adding index to data, to the table that already contains some data. We are actively working on that, so things should change over the next months. But if you require those features, you maybe want to wait a little bit for them. So in order to use SQL API, you can use dedicated SDK and directly talk to ImmuDB. But you can also talk using Go standard SQL libraries. And also, we've implemented PostgreSQL binary protocol compatibility. So you can easily talk to ImmuDB by connecting with already existing PostgreSQL connectors and just use our own dialect of SQL for that. We also have a full roadmap ahead of us of new features that should come in the next few months. So we think about physical deletion of the data, and it's a very interesting problem, because we have to, if there's data that you actually want to wipe from the database to free this disk space, we have to guarantee that we can still prove the consistency of the history. And we also work a lot on SQL right now. That's, I would say, our major point of focus. So we work on alter tables, creating indexes for tables that already contain data. We also want to add more types to our MUDB, like float. We work also on exposing database schema in SQL so that you can, let's say, query what are the column names of given table. We also want to support common SQL and ORM libraries like GORM in Golang, and want to keep improving compatibility with PostgreSQL protocol. On the key value level, we want to improve transactions so that they are much easier to work with. And also we want to let people mix key value and SQL within one transaction. And of course, we constantly work on performance and scalability improvements. So the major goal actually is to make sure that MUDB could be used as a primary database. So if you create a website or a small application or also larger deployment, you should be able to consider MUDB as the primary database for your data. Okay, so now let's do a quick demo of how we can talk with to MUDB server. So for that purpose, let's start an MUDB server in the background. MUDB is distributed as a single binary, so running is trivial. Just execute this binary and that's it. We have MUDB running in the background, and now we can start coding. So here I have an example project. It will be written in Golang. So there's an SDK for Go, which I already downloaded. So first thing that I need to do is to create a client object for this SDK. And within this client object, I need to open a session to the database. And I need to also provide a context. That's something that Golang requires. Here I specify username. By default, it's MUDB. I also specify password, which is also by default MUDB. And also I have to specify the name of the database, which is by default DB. Yeah. Of course, we need to check if it errors out. I have a trivial method to check and panic basically if the error is not null. And also we want to be a good citizen. So once we're done with everything, let's just close existing session so that MUDB can just clean up everything. And once we've done, let's say that we want to say connected. Okay, very simple code, just a few lines of code, and that's all you have to do to connect to MUDB. So let's see how it works. Yep, we successfully connected to MUDB database. So let's do a few operations, like let's set some value. The key would be false dem, and value, let's say it is, of course, 2022. So what we do is take the client object and set the value. And that's it. It's very simple. Of course, let's check if there was an error. And if there was no error, let's just print line what was the transaction ID. So talking to the database is very simple. The API is very trivial. Let's see how it works. So it added value to the database, and the current transaction ID is 2. If you run it again, it will create new transaction with this value, and we see that it's just constantly increasing. So now let's try to read the value from the database. So instead of the get, we use the instead of set operation, we use get operation. And let's see what the database returned to us. Okay, so here's a simple example how you can read the value from the MDB database. Let's save it and run it. Let's see what it gives us. Yeah, and it correctly said that the value was 2022, so exactly what we've specified. So we may also extend this get into a verified operation, which is actually asking the database to give us not only the value, but also the proof. A simple get will be a little bit faster, of course. So if we don't need a proof that the value is correct, we can just use that one. But if we want to have the proof and want to be sure that the value is correct, we can just use the verified operation. So if I run this, everything is fine. It looks like exactly the previous example, but we want different one difference. So if we take a look at local files, you can see that there's some kind of state file that we did not create that appeared here. And that's exactly how by default the Golang SDK is persisting the state of the database over time. So it stores this onto local folder with into the, those files, and on next operation, next verified operation, it will just read this file and ensure that the database can prove that this new state is consistent with the old value. Okay, I will finish my demo here. And now let's move back to slides. So let's think about where actually IMDB could be used. So it's very good as a content specific database. Like if you want to store some documents, or maybe users, or some configuration of a system, that's a very good fit because IMDB would protect this information. So every data that you have to protect, basically, that you have to make sure that nobody is messing around. Also, if you want to have a history of changes into the database, that's where IMDB shines, and you can query the history of given key. And also, if you need to have some kind of audit trails, some kind of reliable ledgers, maybe logs of important actions in your system, that's where you can use IMDB, because it will store this in a secure manner. But there are also use cases where IMDB is not a good fit, actually. So things like a contest, things like change frequently, it won't be a good use, because on every such change, IMDB will create a new entry. So the database will grow over time and it won't be able to reclaim the space. Also, if you have some kind of temporary data, you should not use IMDB, because right now there's no way to get rid of that data once it's removed. Of course, we are working on that. And also right now, because it's not yet implemented, we cannot change SQL schemas. So if you want to have migrations in the future, you may wait a little bit. But we hope to change this really, really soon. There's also a question that once you have IMDB, how to use it securely? Because the state, internal state of IMDB must be constantly validated against the historical values. So this validation is done on few operations, like this verified get, verified set operation executed through SDK, and SDK actually is doing this proof under the hood. And also you can run a dedicated auditor process, so IMDB in dedicated audit mode that is checking running IMDB if its state is correct. And depending on the security level you require and some technical challenges that you can face, this can be done in different ways. So let's take a few examples. Like first approach is to just not have any validation at all. So we have just a standard application where there's a user and there's a web service that exposes some kind of API that the user talks to, and there is an IMDB in the backend. And we just write this application as a standard application. We just talk to the IMDB directly. And it may look like this doesn't bring us any value, but in fact, IMDB itself is already bringing a value. It will already check if the state internal state is consistent, and also if you separate it, like use some kind of hosted version or use version that is deployed on a separated installation or separated infrastructure, it will be much harder to attack, because immutable itself, the interface, the API interface, is guarantee you that you cannot mess with the history. And of course, we can do better. Like we can spawn this arbiter process that I talked about before, that is storing the last known state and is constantly talking to immutable, asking for the current state. Actually, it's more optimized. But if there's any tampering done on the immutable, arbiter would quickly detect it and notify administrator. And it's also good to have this arbiter installed separately, like in deployment that uses different credentials, so that it cannot be easily attacked when you attack the web service itself. We can also do the state validation on the web service itself. So that way, the web service will constantly watch for changes in immutable, and if there is any suspicious activity, or if immutable cannot make the proof, the web service can just block the request and not forward it to the user, and just notify administrator that something bad has happened. And also very good approach is, and actually the best way of monitoring the state, is if the user itself validates the state. So this is a little bit more complex, because the web service then have to proxy the proof from immutable back to the user. So the user has to know, understand the proof and be able to validate it. So it's not as trivial as in web service, because the complexity of the user software needs to be increased. But because our users are usually very distributed units and there are many users, this is the best way to start validating the state. And of course, of all those solutions, the best one is the mixed one. So if we validate the state between each component, that's where any kind of tampering made on the database can be very easily spotted. And I call this trust no one. So every component of the system has limited trust to other components and constantly requires the proof to be done. And of course, the more validation method you can implement into your system, the better, because each point will be another protection against attack. But depending on your constraints of your environment, it may be actually hard to implement all the validations. Like let's say that the user, the client, is just a tiny device that is measuring temperature and setting it to some kind of web service. This device may actually not be capable of performing the proof, or it may not have any storage for the previous state. So you always have to consider your own environment. But the golden rule also is, the more distributed your system is, the more distributed parts are checking on each other, the harder it will be to attack. For example, you can spawn the arbiter process even in a separate cloud provider and just have a tunnel between your components, and the attacker would have to attack both your base infrastructure and the secondary validating infrastructure for this purpose. And here is also an example of the CAS project that we have developed inside Code Notary, which is very similar to the previous slides. So we have a client, which is a CAS CLI binary, which is a binary client that you can use to talk to data to our CAS backend. Inside the CAS backend, we have the data service, which is an REST endpoint, which is exposing API that a CAS binary is using. And we have immutable inside. So our state validation is done on two areas. First one is that we have an external arbiter process that is validating the state and checking if immutable is valid. And we also have the state validation on the client binary. And you can see on your own how it worked by just creating an account there and downloading CAS binary and trying to notarize files. You will see that the state files that I shown you before are actually produced by this binary. And this is a very, very good setup, and it's very hard to attack. So thank you for your attention. I hope that I shown you interesting idea about how to use mathematics and cryptography to secure your systems. If you are interested in MinBDB, here are some links that you can visit. There is an MinBDB.io homepage, GitHub repository, documentation. Also, there is a link to our Discord channel. So if you can talk to us directly, just join and ask us questions. And there is also a CodeMonitor webpage and a direct link to the CAS website. And if you want to contact me directly, just send an email to bart@codemonitor.com. Thank you.